Okay, good morning, everybody. Gerrit Sauer asked me to give some kind of introduction what first principle electronic structure calculations can do for spintronics. And so this is a seminar which is prepared by two of the participants of this spintronics meeting. There will be a talk by Kazunori Sato, who will speak about finite temperature magnetism, which is an important issue in the spintronics in the field of spintronics. And I will give some introductory remarks on what electronic structure calculations can do, state of the art electronic structure calculations at the moment. And I will spend some time on application of first principle calculations to transport. So, and my first transparency is, I come from the university in Halle. Halle is for sure a place which is not well known all over the world, but it's not so far from Berlin. This is one. Second, maybe you have seen the movie of Martin Luther, which is very, Martin Luther was a person who was active in Wittenberg, and Wittenberg is part of our university. So we are a very old university, 500 years old. And the third is, probably you know Patrick Bruno, and Patrick Bruno is also in Halle. It's at the Max Planck Institute, but the university, our building is just across the street, so we have very tight collaboration. And to give some introduction to what electronic structure calculations can do, I will start with intrinsic electronic structure. Then I will talk a little bit about how to deal defects or disorder in the system, impurity scattering or substitutional alloys. And then I will show you some applications to transport calculations in the limit of linear response. And finally, I would give some short remarks on what we have to do beyond local density approximation, since this is important if you want to treat semiconductors or oxides, and even for some correlated metals it's important. And the next point would be finite temperature magnetism, which is the next talk then given by Dr. Sato. So intrinsic electronic structure, so what do? We solve the Kohn-Chem equation. I mean, the equations in our field are very simple for everybody. The problem consists in implementing, solving them. So, and these are the numerical things that are done by people who are doing electronic structure calculations. So we solve the Kohn-Chem equation. And I would like to use a formalism which is based on Green's functions, which is an equivalent formulation of the Kohn-Chem equation. This is a single particle Green function, which is used in this description. And it has the advantage that you then can, starting from a simple Green function for a simple solvable system, you can construct or describe any other system by solving a Dyson equation. So you can really get a hierarchy of Green functions, which leads you to more and more complicated systems than that you can describe on the basis of ab initio electronic structure calculations. So
a way of iteration or procedure when the atoms are considered as similar, this small difference. Why to change, how to change from one compound to the other?
Now, maybe we start from, let's start from a very simple system, which is, for example, which are, for example, free electrons. It's not very well adapted to our theory, but then you know the Green function. And then you introduce an arrangement of atoms that you want to consider. embedded in the free electron gas, and then you solve this Dyson equation and you get the green function of the whole system. But so what the theory that we are using, it's based on a multiple scattering basis, so it's the so-called Korinka-Cohn-Rostocker theory, and we use some newer versions of this. This is the so-called screen KKR, which is an n-scaling scheme, and it was developed over the last 10 years. Or there is another method which is very well adapted to layered systems, and this is the layered KKR, which really is based on scattering theory from layer to layer, so it uses the reflection and transmission coefficients intrinsically. But now let me describe what I mean with this Green's function, with this hierarchy of Green's function. So you could start. Yeah, we can. In principle, the state-of-the-art codes have the option of using Muffin-Tin or ASA spheres, which is numerical not as demanding. So you have the opportunity of spherical potential, but the codes are also developed to full potential. We have always the option of doing full potential calculations if it's necessary. But this is, of course, then a numerical much more demanding. So let's say we start from a bike system. It's a simple system. It can be one atom per unit cell, or it can be a large unit cell with many atoms per unit cell. And then you obtain the Green function of the system. You have all the information that you need. You have the electronic structure. You have, I will show that later on. Then you can even consider such an inverse slab. Inverse slab, and then you solve it self-consistently. By this Green's function technique, you can always solve it self-consistently, and the pink color means that you can take into account charge relaxation within a region which is important for the system. So the same way as you consider this inverse slab, you can consider a surface, and you would also have this charge relaxation here at the surface. Or you can start from a slab, which is, you have no periodic boundary conditions, which is a freestanding film, and you put at layers on top, or you take a surface which is open boundary condition, which means open boundary conditions, and you put an ad layer on top. So the good thing for all these layered systems, bulk would of course also include multi-layers, since it's a translational invariance periodic system. The good thing for these layered systems is it's n-scaling. The trick is that we use some trick in between, and so the Green's function matrix is bent. Is tridiagonal, has the behavior of a band matrix. So you have really, in comparison to calculations several decades ago, where you had the scaling with the number n to the power of 4 in the unit cell, you are really able to deal huge unit cells, 100 to even several hundred atoms per unit cell, which is very near to what you want to do in nanoscience. So, delta V in this respect, delta V here, would be the difference of the potentials that you have in the spacer with respect to the bulk material. Delta V means you have a potential in the bulk material, and this you know per sight, and you take out these atoms in the inverse spacer. This is like vacuum, and then you get the potential difference between the vacuum and the original bulk, and you even consider some potential difference which comes from charge redistribution at the interface or at the surface. So this is what if you change the charge, then of course you get another potential from the electron-electron interaction, another effective one-particle potential, I should say correctly. G-bulk could be, in this case, is all translational invariance. You start from a periodic system, a unit. This can be copper, it can be iron, it can be...
Can you link it to this, this pink area in between?
Yeah, to this?
How does this linking work? If you take something which is translational invariant,
now the good thing is this you solve translational invariant, and then you have a quantum number k, a Bloch vector, and then you do this transformation to a system like this, and then you have translational invariance only anymore in a plane, which means you have a new set of quantum numbers, which is the k parallel. This is, can be linked directly, but in this direction, you have now an algebraic set to solve. It's just the number of potentials that are different from the bulk potential will give you a contribution, and the rest is linked to the surface Green's function, which is like a recursion method for Green's function that we use. I mean, these are all tricks that are also used by people in the non-ab initio community, but it's now transferred into these codes. So.
If you would start from a confined system, say you have or this order and confinement that you have, so that you have no translation invariance, how would this scale then if you also increase the size?
What do you mean with disorder? Substitutional disorder or?
Something which breaks the translational symmetry.
In this direction or in any direction. Then, of course, if you break the translational symmetry, you cannot solve the system in this sense. Then you have to do a CPA calculation. And you, this is then a regular, if you don't have a sparse matrix, which the Green function matrix, which is in a site representation, if you don't have a sparse matrix, and you cannot use these techniques of either it's a tri-diagonal form or sparse, then you have to, then it's of order n to the power of 3 or 4, or something in between. Okay.
And is here implicitly accepted that bulk on the left is the same as bulk on the right, or at least the same translational symmetry?
No, it's really it's important that charge relaxation into your system, since in a metal, it's like the Fermi wavelengths. In this, we have charge relaxation on a very short scale. So, and this, you have to be sure that you take this charge relaxation into account, and the rest, the potentials look like in bulk, which would also mean for a future transport calculation, these are ideal leads, and this is the perturbed region.
But because there is the same G-bulk, does it mean that gallium arsenide should be on the left and on the right, or gallium arsenide on the left and gallium aluminium arsenide or something like that?
This could also be done. Also, it's a little more complicated. This would be this figure would tell you that it's just that both are gallium arsenide. But if you use the layer KKR code, which is another code, you can easily construct what you mentioned that you have different leads left and right. In this, in the first version, we have like a parent lattice. Parent means, so it's then the same left and right, but it's developed and you also can do it in any other way. So let me continue then. What you get out from all these calculations, of course, is the green function, and with the green function you have the charge density and you have the density of states, but you also have the spectral, the wave functions, the Bloch functions, if you have Bloch functions, or if you don't have full transitional invariance, you have just also decaying wave functions, you have the bands, and you can also solve the Cohn-Chem equation, then you have the bands, you have the Fermi surface, and you have the velocities, whatever you want, in really taking into account the full anisotropy. So now extrinsic electronic properties. This Green's function, the Green function technique is really very nice, since you can also now put any defect. If you start, for example, from a superlattice, you can put defects into the system and solve again now a more complicated Dyson equation, but it's not anymore so complicated, since this delta V is only different for a number of for a special number of atoms around the defect. So it's an algebraic set that you have to solve then. And you could also do the following, which is quite interesting at the moment. If you start from this semi-infinite leads, the system that I have described before, you can put like a constriction in here, and you do also the same impurity calculation for this area, and then you have really you can calculate this impurity potential here or here self-consistently for the region of interest. And if you then are interested in the scattering properties, if you have the wave the Bloch functions available from the unperturbed system, you calculate such a T matrix, which is the incoming wave, then the impurity potential, which, if it's, for example, such a layered structure, of course the impurity potential depends on the position in this layered structure. And this is the outgoing Bloch wave, which is the full, this is the perturbed Bloch wave, which is not Born approximation. You solve this by inversion, and all orders of perturbation are included in here. And we usually describe this then by a T matrix, and then you have the Bloch wave left and right. And if you have this T matrix, then we use Fermi's golden rule, and you get the scattering probabilities of a defect or of an arrangement of defects in your system, which is just the scattering, which gives you the scattering cross sections of such a defect. And if you sum up over all final states, and in the inversion gives you the relaxation time, which is the time or the lifetime of an electron sitting in a special state on your Fermi surface.
Sorry, I don't understand
yeah.
What is the justification for using T square? I mean, if it's V square, you see, I can imagine that's the imaginary part of T2, then that's a golden, that's the Fermi golden rule. But if you actually had a T matrix
here, you mean?
It's the imaginary part of the linear T matrix that is the same possibility and not the square.
The T matrix that we define here is, of course, you have a real and an imaginary part. The real part of the T matrix gives you the change in the electronic bands somehow, and the imaginary part gives you the damping, which so you get a finite lifetime.
What is the second line there?
This one.
Yes.
It's just Fermi's golden rule. And this means
from what you just said.
We take this T matrix,
yes,
And we consider the probability from an electron, and this takes the real and the imaginary part into account. This is a complex number, and this describes the probability of an electron of being scattered from a state k into a state k prime, and into there are it's a huge variety of states. And if you sum up k over all k prime, you get the time now, a finite lifetime of the electron, since it's not anymore a stationary state.
I still don't understand the proof. So we have talked about a number that says that it is beyond the Born If you suppose we let's express with some simple potential that we can do in terms of space.
Right.
And can you check that in fact the problem, and we know the exact answer in terms of space.
Mm-hmm. You can for simple cases where you don't have, let's say we use the same formalism for a simple band which is isotropic. Then you can, of course, you can derive in principle, you are right, these quantities are, in these quantities you have the phase shifts included. Yeah, and you can derive in a very simple model from this, you can derive an expression with the phase shifts, what we did also before, which include just phase shifts of scatter. If you take just one potential, one scattering potential, then you, as many states as you include in your basis, then you get, since we have a scattering basis, then you get the phase shift for the S, P, and D states.
Somehow that formula seems to me overcounts the
something. I don't think so. I think it's really, I mean, the only approximation that's included that we restrict ourselves to elastic scattering. This is the only. Which is right. It's the optical theorem can also be used, and this gives you the same. The relaxation time, the inverse relaxation time, is proportional to the imaginary part of this T matrix. It's correct. But
the optical theorem is the forward scattering. This is not a forward scattering matrix.
Sorry? No, this is a full scattering matrix. In the limit, maybe this is the point.
Scattering means k is equal to k prime.
You mean forward scattering? I didn't understand that. I thought you mean. No, this is a full scattering matrix, but in the limit. This I have to mention. Maybe this makes the confusion. It's of course only valid in the limit of dilute alloys. It's only if you have only a few defects here, then of course you have this. It's not. You cannot write the same expression for the for concentrated alloys.
Sorry, I don't want to talk
about that. No, I mean maybe we can discuss that later on.
Isn't this formula almost just the definition of a T-matrix?
The T-matrix, actually, maybe the T-matrix that we are using is defined by the green function. So, by the first line. If I take this green function and I take this delta V, then I would have to put that in forward, but I can define an equation. The T matrix is defined in the way that I have a delta T, and then it's and this is equivalent. What we are here using is equivalent. It's like a Lippmann-Schwinger equation, and then it's if instead of the green function, the Bloch function is used, then you get this perturbed wave function that is included. And we solve this equation by inversion. So we really have the full wave function. So we add up all orders of perturbation. So maybe we can discuss that later, and then I continue here a little bit. So this time that we are now obtain here, this relaxation time, as I mentioned, the unperturbed system, then we have a stationary state, and the electron is forever in such a state. Now we have scattering, and the electron has a finite lifetime. And so what we just to illustrate it, it's you can really now ask what are the lifetimes for a copper defect in a cobalt matrix, and this is the units of femtoseconds per atom percent, and this is the minority Fermi surface, this is the majority Fermi surface, and if you ask what are the differences in the lifetimes for a bulk system, they are not very large. That is a scale of 25 to 60, which is a factor of 2. And this is a scale of 580. This in the majority channel, there is much less scattering, so you have much longer lifetimes. And you have, it's a factor, it's also less than a factor of 2. But I wanted to point out that this behavior can change drastically as soon as you have a defect in next, if you have the symmetry is broken and you have a defect next to a surface or to an interface. Here we have the lifetimes. Just we count the number of states with a special lifetime on the Fermi surface, and this width is the same scale that I discussed. This is this factor of 2 that they change for the minority electrons, and for the majority it's again a copper defect in cobalt. Now if you go for example to a cobalt copper multilayer and you put the defect at the interface, the copper defect at the cobalt interface, then you see there is already, the width is important, so there is a strong change of this scattering. There is a strong anisotropy of scattering in these systems, which is goes over several orders of magnitude. And even if you go, if the defect is in the center of the layer, it's even wider. So you can get a wide distribution. This means that this isotropic, the model of isotropic relaxation times or of a constant relaxation time is quite good for bulk material, but for such layered systems or surfaces, it really fails. And the important thing is that then there are states which have a huge contribution, and the others, they simply don't count in transport since they have this small lifetimes. So let me continue then. Transport properties in linear response. So what we do usually are two regimes. We consider transport in diffusive limit or in the ballistic limit. Diffusive means we use all this scattering cross sections that we calculated, and then we calculate a resistivity and we obtain Ohm's law or a conductivity. Or we are in the ballistic limit, then there is no scattering in our sample, in especially in our nanostructure, and then we calculate the conductance, which is not anymore given by Ohm's law. And this is then based, these calculations are based on Boltzmann or Kubo, and these calculations are Landauer, but also, which can be shown, it's also equivalent to Kubo. So for the Boltzmann equation, what we did, we start from a Boltzmann equation, we consider this scattering term, and this is now the scattering probability that we considered, and these are the G or the deviations from the equilibrium distribution, which have to be calculated. If we assume a linear response, then we transform this to vector mean free path, And this is now the so-called scattering out term, which gives you, if I sum up, this gives you the relaxation time. And this is the scattering in term. I forgot to make brackets. This is the scattering in term, which is known in for concentrated alloys and cupo. These are the vertex corrections. So now let me consider a little bit this equation. If we consider time reversal symmetry, again, I forgot the brackets. Time reversal symmetry gives you the following, that if you then the velocity and vector mean free path change sign, and this, then you can write the same equation in the following way. Then this part is given by the symmetric part of the microscopic scattering probability, which is formed in this way. It's just the symmetric part. And this is, if you sum up over k prime, it's the relaxation time. And this is given by the anti-symmetric part. So this means you can analyze scattering now. The symmetric part is somehow a measure for isotropic scattering, whereas this anti-symmetric part is a measure for anisotropic scattering. And if you, it's of course complicated to analyze the data. You have a huge amount of data, since k and k prime on the Fermi surface are related to each other. But what we did is we tried to get some idea of how anisotropic this scattering is, and when, as soon as this is highly anisotropic, then the vertex corrections are important. If it's not anisotropic, then you can neglect the vertex corrections. And what you see here, it's we just divided the anisotropic by the isotropic part to get some visualization of this, and we considered a cobalt, a magnetic defect, a magnetic cobalt defect in copper, and then you see in the minority band, it's highly isotropic. Majority, you get some anisotropy, which mainly comes from the p states. So this is mainly scattering from p states, whereas the other case, you take bulk cobalt and put some copper defects in. You see, it's again on every sheet of the Fermi surface. The different sheets are here superimposed. The scattering is rather isotropic, whereas in the majority band, again due to the p electrons, this scattering is really anisotropic. Okay, this is just a way of saying it, that, and I put so much effort in this scattering cross sections to present that here, since I think this is quite useful for the spin, to analyze the anomalous Hall effect and probably also the spin Hall effect, since this is, you can do that in ferromagnets, and you can do it in normal metals, whatever you want, and you have this scattering cross section. You can even do it for not for the Bloch functions of a spin polarized solution, but you can solve the Pauli equation, and you can calculate scattering cross sections with the solution of the Pauli equation, which would be the appropriate thing to do. Okay, now
Let me ask a question.
Yeah.
So you're assuming here that PKK prime is equal to PK prime.
Yeah, this is for the solution of the Boltzmann equation. I assumed that, but this is not necessary for my case. When I did calculations solving this Boltzmann equation, it was for metals and with inversion symmetry. So I could assume the principle of microscopic reversibility. But this would be just different than you would have the other. You would have to calculate two scattering cross sections.
Okay. So can you, do you know a precise statement of when it's true that PKK prime equals PK prime K?
For sure it's true if you have inversion symmetry, and it's probably true for systems without spin orbit interaction. But I'm not quite sure. We have been discussing about with Arne about how does it look like this principle of microscopic reversibility if you have no more inversion symmetry in the system, and if you have
or if you have, let's say, many common ferromagnets have inversion symmetry.
Yes.
But they have spin orbit coupling, and they.
But the point is that in all these calculations that I did, they are based on a spin polarized case. So spin orbit coupling in the calculations that I did until now is not included. There is another way of considering systems that I discussed not in detail. You can start from a Dirac equation. And from a Dirac equation, of course, you have a very compact solution and everything is in, and then you have a green function which belongs to a Dirac equation, and then you can solve with this green function, you solve the Kubo formula, which was done by two groups by many other groups, but especially Hubert Ebert did lots of calculations based on Dirac equation for concentrated alloys, taking in and calculating transport properties also. Okay, this is just this. I spent so much time on it since I think it's quite helpful to consider spin Hall and or the anomalous Hall effect. And let me continue then for ferromagnets. If you have if you solve the Boltzmann equation, you have the vector mean free path available, and then of course you can calculate the conductivity tensor. You have all components, you combine all components, and then you have to solve this integration, and you use the two current model. That means for ferromagnets without spin orbit, you sum up over the two spin directions. And the important thing that I want to mention at this point, in these calculations or in these systems, all states over the Fermi surface is, of course, weighted by their relaxation times, contribute to the conductivity, which is quite different from the ballistic transport, and which is also quite different from, as I mentioned, layered systems, since the relaxation times are so different in these layered structures or systems with a surface, then you get highly anisotropic relaxation times, and then the relaxation time is in here, which is a weighting factor of your state contributing to the conductivity. Okay, now I spent already a lot of time. I wanted, maybe I skip this, which is not so interesting, and I go to the next part, which is coherent transport. If we want to consider transport in the in the coherent limit, then we solve for a layered system. We calculate the transmission coefficients, k parallel resolved for a layered structure. We integrate over all these transmission coefficients, and it's generalized. It's E over H square, conductance quantum. And to calculate the transmission coefficients, we again use the green functions, a green function technique, which was the formulas have been derived by Baranger and Stone. So what we now do, we connect green functions on the left-hand side of in the ideal lead, left-hand side, with the green function elements of the ideal lead and the right ideal right lead. We combine them, and in between we have the current matrix elements, which are derivatives of the wave functions. So. And again, in a spin-polarized case, it is spin-dependent, and you get this for each spin direction, and you have to sum up over the spin directions, which is, again, the two-current model. Okay, and then if, for example, for the tunneling magnetoresistance, you want to take into account the bias, we do it like it's shown here. We assume a difference in the Fermi levels in the left and right lead, and linear dependence in the barrier. And then we calculate, of course, these coefficients energy dependent, and we have to integrate over the whole window of energy. And then finally also to sum up over all k parallel. So maybe here I would like to show you some example what we did with this whole formalism on for the calculation of tunneling magnetoresistance. So it's now the following case. We calculate the tunneling current for a tunnel junction with semi-infinite leads, open boundary conditions for parallel alignment of the magnetization in the leads and anti-parallel alignment. And as a function of the alignment in your leads, you get a large or a small current. And then you obtain the tunneling magnetoresistance, which is large for anti-parallel alignment. You also have the inverse effect, but for most of the systems you have this case. And it's small for parallel alignment, and then we have we calculate TMR in the following way. And this is now an example where ab initio calculations had really some predictive power. The first calculations for a system which is nice for ab initio, for the ab initio community, since it grows epitaxially. In comparison, aluminum oxide, which was used in the very beginning for all these tunnel junctions, is amorphous, and we cannot handle easily an amorphous barrier. So iron magnesium oxide is quite nice. And there was a prediction already in 2001 by Bill Butler, and also by Bill Butler and George Maton, that there is a huge magnetoresistance of 1000%. Nobody believed that at that time that this has some real, this is real. And the reason why this effect is so large, it was really not, nobody could explain that with Julliard's model, which was widely used. But the reason is the following. Now, in comparison to the transport in the diffusive limit, where all the states on the Fermi surface contribute to the conductance, only a few states are responsible. And so the spin polarization can be even higher than in a bulk system. For the polarization of the tunneling current can be even larger for one of these states or for some of these states than for a bulk system. So if you want to argue that you have a spin polarization of 70% concerning the density of states at the Fermi energy, this is not at all important for tunneling, since there might be half metallic behavior in the there might be tunneling only in one bend bend of your system, and in the minority bend and not in the majority, or vice versa.
Isn't it accepted that momentum is conserved when passing through the interface?
This is coherent tunneling. K parallel momentum is conserved. Right. Specular. This is specular. You're right. So now.
Is this the same in the experiments?
And it's of course in the experiments you cannot say if momentum is conserved or not, but you can try to produce very clean samples, and that I want to show it now later on. Here you see that many years later, 2004, Shinji Yuasa produced nicely grown samples. This is iron.
Parkin's experiment.
Parkin, this is a Japanese group, but Parkin, but Parkin did the same experiment on my next sample. I have Parkin. But then you have really, this is atomic resolution, and you see it's like theorists like it. It's epitaxially grown, atomically flat layers, nice interfaces.
This group grows a single crystal manganese oxide. Parkin's group is polycrystalline.
This is single crystalline magnesium oxide here in between. For this reason I have, but the big TMR ratios, which are now much higher than was expected before, have been observed by you, also by Parkin. Also, there are two papers of Bob Berman's group, which are also dealing with the iron magnesium oxide now. And you see, low temperature, you have about 250% of TMR. Yeah.
We observe also quite huge TMR for amorphous leads.
Yes.
And can you explain why you're sorry, why?
Yeah, I didn't prepare that, but I can say it with some words. We did now calculations. Maybe I even have to stop after tunneling, since I used already too long time for this. The point is, what we check is the following.
Better for amorphous leads, or
the amorphous, the leads are, we can show that the leads are not important at all. The it really counts. You have to have a crystalline barrier, and you have to have at least one or two crystalline magnetic layers next to the interface. And this makes the whole tunneling. This is like a filter. So we considered the following system. You have your magnesium oxide barrier. This is MgO. Then you have some iron left and right. And we change the thickness. And then you have amorphous leads, left and right. Or you can also try, you can take any reservoir, free electrons, or you can take copper, whatever. You always get the same result. And if you analyze the TMR as a function of thickness, and this is now the number of iron layers, thickness in monolayers. Okay, you know what I mean. Then it's already with, you get some effect, and then you get some oscillations, and this is the infinite iron value. So I mean the leads, but we did some calculations, and we can really show the leads are just a reservoir. And it is not necessary that the leads are spin polarized, they just have to deliver electrons all the time. And then this small region, or the interface region, makes all, is responsible for the rest in your system. So. And I think this is, I can show you some other results, that some other calculations, and then I finish. Before the amorphous leads have been of interest, there was a very careful analysis of this interface structure by the group of Meyerheim in Halle, and they analyzed both interfaces. First, since they are different, you grow from. And they found out that there is an iron oxide layer between the leads and the barrier. And Yuasa did similar experiment, and you can trigger the growth, or you can suppress this iron oxide layer by the oxygen pressure. So what we did then, we did some calculations for different systems. I mean now no iron oxygen, iron oxygen using the experimental results, how the structural data from experiment, and one iron oxide layer. And we have been asking ourselves, how does the TMR curves versus bias look like? And you see they are totally different. These are the two symmetric cases. So they are symmetric concerning bias reversal. And this is the asymmetric sample with one iron oxide layer, and you can get any bias dependence, which is not very similar to experimental results, what you obtain. But in experiment, you probably have something like this. You have areas where you have this iron oxide layer and areas where you don't have it. And sometimes you have it on both sides, sometimes you have it only on one side. And if you mix it, you can nicely produce also the behavior also with the right size of this experimentally obtained IV characteristics. And I think I should stop here, since otherwise we are running out of time. I used already nearly 1 hour. And we have another talk. So I only want to say at the end I had much more transparencies, but I skip all this. But I want to say that all these results have been produced by my group, and I should say thank you. Who did the calculations? This is the last transparency I would like to show you. And this is most of the calculations have been done by students Peter Zahn, Alexei Bakritz, Bogdan Jaworski, Christian Heiliger. The results that I presented are mainly done by these people. Thank you very much.
University in the background?
This is, the building. How it looks like, right. Okay. Thank you for your attention. So we had lots of discussions in between. Maybe we should immediately go to the other talk, or is there still some need?
Is it any simple explanation why two layers, monolayers of magnetic material are enough for electrons, and you use elastic picture?
Yeah.
Actually, in the simplest way, I would expect some kind of precession of electrons in the field of magnetic layer. And that's all. So why electrons learn about being in ferromagnet during the passage of two monolayers?
Now,
something for intuition.
The picture that I have is that these are the matrix elements. Either the states fit to each other, or it's like a filter. It's like this magnetic layer. It acts like a filter, and some K states pass through, and some don't. And with this, you immediately produce the polarization of the current, since this filter acts differently for the majority and minority electrons.
I can understand it, but in this way, it is difficult to reproduce all the states on the Fermi surface of iron, because some of them maybe are incompatible.
Right.
The plane waves in non-magnetic material, so some of spots on the Fermi surface are matched to non-magnetic material and are filled with electrons, but different are not matched to non-magnetic material. they should remain empty. So why the saturation? Maybe 50% it would be okay, but nearly 100%. After passage, only two more
away. Show you, it's maybe four. I don't know exactly if it's, but there is already 50% after one layer. And there is, and this, we did the calculations up to 20 or more layers.
This is very similar to the spin transfer for the reason is, I think, the exchange entry is so large, so that everything happens essentially on the scale of Fermi wavelength.
Yeah.
The
question would be, if you do the GMR, you also find the maximum GMR already for four monolayers.
Actually, did we do the GMR with the GMR is, no, I would not find the same. For GMR, it's much more different, since right. That's what I wanted to say. This was my statement before. Here, what you at this interface, from the non-magnetic reservoir to iron, you get some first filtering, which still gives you lots of states. But then the important thing for tunneling, that you for the GMR you would not get it in the same as fast as here. For tunneling, then what happens is, in the extreme case, it's just one state that comes through, and then you have the polarization.
It also means that, for example, if you do it for a different ferromagnet, there's no guarantee whatsoever that you find the same extreme filtering characteristics.
For a different ferromagnet instead of iron?
Yes, for nickel.
It really depends. We can do the calculations, but it doesn't fit so well. There are other, they don't grow on each other easily. So.
I don't think it's universal.
Might be. But the other thing what I wanted to say is, if you use an amorphous barrier, you are really right. If you use crystalline material here, then you get still a nice, let's say, conductance map with pronounced states. But for amorphous, if you use amorphous, I can show you the map later on, it's just like equal distribution of states over the area of the Fermi surface. Every state has the same contribution.
And what about two or three layers? Will it be also enough or not?
You mean what? Two or three layers?
Two or three layers to get separation.
Of which material? Two or three layers?
Of amorphous.
Of amorphous. I can show you. I don't want to stress my time, but this afternoon I can show you the result. I have it already. You can, with amorphous, you can see if you put the few layers, four layers amorphous material, then crystalline iron, four layers amorphous material. You get nice, very soon you get a resistivity like Ohm's law, and you get already with a few layers amorphous material, you get already what you expect. Okay, thank you very much for your attention, and we should continue with the next talk by Dr. Sato on the
C'est dans une liste. Ah, yes. Ok, so. In this talk, I'd like to discuss finite temperature magnetism in dielectric magnetic semiconductors. I'm Kazunori Sato from Osaka University and collaborators are shown here. Since the organizer asked me to give a general overview concerning to finite temperature magnetism in DMS, so I'd like to start with some general introduction about ab initio simulation at finite temperature. Today, it becomes possible to simulate atomic motion in solid state from first principles. This is called ab initio molecular dynamics. In this method, we calculate a force acting on the impurity, acting on atoms from first principles calculations, and then we solve the equation of the motion to follow the trajectory of atoms. For example, this is a molecular dynamics simulation of kappa in silicon. And the red circles are kappa and the blue circles are silicon lattices. And you can find this trajectory, you can find this diffusion of kappa in silicon. It is well known that kappa diffuses very fast in silicon lattice, and they succeeded to reproduce the diffusion constant of kappa in silicon. So this kind of molecular dynamics simulation is now very much successful, and it is applied to many problems. For example, phase transformation and impurity diffusion and chemical reaction on surfaces and so on. And recently, Antropov tried to apply this kind of dynamics simulation for spin systems. This is so-called ab initio spin dynamics. And he in this method, he calculated a torque acting on the magnetic moment and solved the equation of motion for magnetic moment. He succeeded to reproduce a very complicated spin structure in FCC iron by using his ab initio spin dynamics, but it turns out that this method is very computationally demanding, and it is very much difficult to apply this method to general problems. So in this talk, I'd like to show there are two practical methods to simulate finite temperature magnetism. One is disordered local moment state by using coherent potential approximation, and the other method is mapping on the Heisenberg model. And I'd like to explain these two methods for a practical method for finite temperature magnetism. In order to explain this disordered local moment technique, first, I'd like to explain what is coherent potential approximation. So coherent potential approximation is developed to simulate, to calculate the configuration average of random substitutional alloy. For example, in case of two-component alloy of atom A and atom B, you have many configurations of atom A and atom B, as shown here. But the physically important thing is not the physical properties of respective configurations, but the important thing is the configuration average of them. In coherent potential approximation, first you suppose that this configuration average properties can be described by using the effective medium. And this effective medium is described by the scattering the scattering T matrix, TCPA. And in CPA method, this TCPA is determined by solving this equation self-consistently. This equation says that scattering path operator for effective medium should be equal to the average of tau A and tau B. Tau A and tau B is a scattering path operator of impurity A and impurity B. They are embedded in the effective medium. In this way, you can calculate the configuration average of two component alloy. This is a CPA method, and for example, this method is applied to calculate the threat appalling curve by Akai in Osaka University. I want to just show the example, and in threat appalling curve, magnetic moment, average magnetic moment is plotted as a function of number of electrons per atom. And this, you find many combination of magnetic atoms. And this is a theoretical result by Akai, and this is an experiment. And you can find very good agreement between theory and experiment. This CPA method can apply not only for the substitutional system, substitutional disorder, but also you can apply it to the magnetically disordered systems. For example, paramagnetic paramagnetic state. In paramagnetic state, direction of local magnetic moment is randomly oriented. So in total, magnetization is zero. This paramagnetic state can be simulated by using CPA. In this case, you introduce two components of magnetic, two magnetic components. They have anti-parallel magnetic moment, and this is called disordered local moment state. So now you have a two-component alloy, and their magnetic moment is anti-parallel with each other. So you have local magnetic moment, but in total, magnetic moment, magnetization is zero. And this local disordered local moment state is simulate this paramagnetic state very well. For example, you can calculate the disordered local moment state of iron, and you get the local magnetic moment of 1.9 mu b. This is very much comparable to the ferromagnetic iron. So you can say that above Curie temperature, iron sustains its magnetic moment, and the local moment picture for the ferromagnetism is reasonable. On the other hand, in nickel, if you try to calculate DLM state for nickel, their magnetic moment becomes very small, and finally you get a non-magnetic solution. This means that in nickel case, stoner picture for ferromagnetism is very much reasonable. Moreover, if you calculate energy difference between ferromagnetic state and this DLM state, you can estimate the Curie temperature by using the mean field approximation. So,
may I ask a question?
Yes.
It looks a little bit different. In CPA, you assume that you have some average medium which consists of up and down.
Yes.
Whereas on the left side,
yes. Yes, it seems a little bit different, but if you if you calculate this tau for arbitrary direction and the average and take spherical average, it turns out this is the same to this one. So it looks very much different, but it is the same. Okay, so this is very useful method for finite temperature magnetism. This one, this method for DMS systems later. And next, I'd like to explain mapping of the Heisenberg model. This is another method for finite temperature magnetism from first principles. In this method, I use this Heisenberg model and try to calculate this exchange coupling constant from first principles calculation. If you once you get exchange coupling constant, then you can use standard statistical method for finite temperature. For example, Curie temperature can be calculated by using mean field approximation or random phase approximation or by using the Monte Carlo simulation. And maybe for calculation method for JIJ, there are three different methods. For example, in Liechtenstein's method, we start with the ferromagnetic state, and then calculate the total energy change due to the rotation of two magnetic moments at site I and site J. And this energy change is mapped onto this Heisenberg model. And then you get exchange coupling constant between site I and site J. And Sandratsky did the same thing in the reciprocal space, and this is called the Hulse-Magnon approach. And Oguchi et al. Started from DL, put two iron at site I and site J, and calculate the total energy difference between parallel and anti-parallel configuration. Recently, this Liechtenstein's method is applied to typical ferromagnetic metals such as iron, cobalt, nickel, and they calculate exchange interactions, Curie temperatures, and magnon dispersion deviations. This is also spin wave stiffness constant. And this is magnon dispersion relation, and points are experimental result. And this is calculated Curie temperature by mean field approximation, random phase approximation, and this is experiment. For iron and cobalt case, they have a very good agreement between theory and the experiment. And for nickel case, agreement is not so satisfactory. So this mapping method can be used for ferromagnets with well-defined magnetic moments. And I also use this method for DMS system. Domain fluctuation. Domain is not in.
I know it isn't, but how do you get perfect answer? Are you saying?
So what type of calculation are you referring to, Lou?
Like Bauer's job, people who do degrees, and they always find the first principle calculation, the Curie temperature is much higher than the experimental thing. That's because.
Right, so this is really the modern version of Geoffroy's calculation.
Because they do have the fluctuation in there.
The point is,
RPA, or if you use Monte Carlo simulation, you can introduce some fluctuation.
If you just did a standard theory, that's what Geoffroy was emphasizing. You get it completely wrong. So this mean field theory is not a Stoner theory. First you calculate the effective magnetic interaction,
okay.
And then you treat that spin model by some kind of mean field theory. So,
this is just a spin
model mean field theory.
Spin model, yeah, because spin models still use, you can have domain problems, right?
Well, all the stiffness and so on is, magnetic stiffness is calculated. And that's what controls TC in these systems. And that's what Geoffroy was saying.
And that's equivalent to what Geoffroy is saying.
Yeah.
Well, but we still have domains are not included.
No.
This is just the assumption that you have a single domain. And
yes.
The properties of a single domain. But the agreement between theory and experiment tells you
it must be that what you're recalling is maybe Geoffroy used some domain wall property as a way of saying something about the stiffness. Mm. But actual domain wall fluctuations are not important for the TC, at least at 10% level, or probably even at a 0.001% level. But they may be important for the critical properties.
Yeah, thank you. So anyway, this method can be used for iron and cobalt, and I use this method for dilute magnetic semiconductor system. So then I move to dilute magnetic semiconductor systems. This is very important material for realizing spintronics, but now gallium manganese arsenide and indium manganese arsenide, for example, have low Curie temperature, lower than room temperature. So many theory propose high Curie temperature materials. For example, this is a famous one, detailed calculated proposed gallium nitride.
Zinc oxide could be very good candidate for high PCB MS based on
general PD model. And also some first calculation proposed high TCD MS. And in this talk, I'd like to discuss finite temperature magnetism by using the two methods which I have discussed in the introduction. And I will discuss origin of the ferromagnetism in DMS, and I also show how accurately we can calculate the Curie temperature of DMS from first principles. And if I have a time, I would like to discuss effect of inhomogeneous impurity distribution in DMS. And this is our electronic structure calculation based on the local spin density approximation, and I use Kolinga-Kohn Rostoka method. And I also use a coherent potential approximation method for simulating the disorder. And I use Machikane-Yama 2002 program package developed by Akai from University. And in DMS systems,
In this
calculation, no spin orbit induction.
But the whole point about the details
of calculation was spin orbit. Anyway, in my calculation, spin orbit induction is not included, and from first principles calculation, I think. This effect is not so large, I think. At least TC.
Yeah, I mean, this is a real problem with these first principles calculations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the size of the exchange splitting. I'm not sure what it is in your calculation, but it's a problem. Something like 0.1, 0.2 volts in your calculation, is that right?
Yes. You mean the exchange splitting
of the band states, let's say, the quasi particle stage.
You mean exchange splitting, or yes? Yeah.
It's around 0.2 volts.
Mm-hmm.
And spin orbit interaction is around 0.3 volts.
Mm-hmm.
So you really can't leave it out.
Okay. Yes, but.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
Got to start somewhere.
Okay. Anyway, I could.
I want to hear what you have to say, because we maybe can build on it, but the point is the band structure of the valence band is very important to the whole, right?
Yes.
And maybe the note is not important.
Now you know what?
Not by me.
We'll wait until
we get to stop. Okay. I see.
But that's a real problem if you do first principle and ignore, you know.
I see.
And I don't think it's so hard to put in an atomic,
This is not so difficult to include the spin orbit interaction.
Yeah, I'll ask you a question. This is just a spin polarized treatment, but of course, could also be a bit more fully relativistic. So you solve the beam application, and then this would be correct.
If your problem is fully relativistic, but some other people then use semi relativistic.
No, I mean,
it's not clear whether you got enough spin orbit in there.
I mean, Dirac.
Yeah, sure, but that's
people
say it's very hard.
No, there are rules.
So why don't people do this?
Okay. So there are, if you ask, maybe what you're referring to, if you ask Alex Unger and presumably many other people, he'll say, I did the calculations with and without spin orbit and there's no difference. Or it doesn't matter.
There's another thing. The first principle calculation,
at least the ones that I have seen, are not very good in reproducing the fine band structures near the band edge.
That's one point.
That's one of the problems.
Well, the gap, but also the details near the edge.
Not just the gap, the effective mass near the gap.
And even more important is the placement of the D level relative to the top of the valence.
That's another thing. Yes, the self-consistent calculation always put the Fermi band, the D level, everything is here, and the Fermi level is pinned.
Not pinned here, but it's because it's D5.
Right.
Yes.
But it's just put in the wrong place.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
But anyway.
Maybe one more comment. Maybe this means, but this problem that you now mentioned, this is beyond, you have to go beyond LDA then to get the spectral density and the band gap correctly. So this is.
Yeah.
But then, and then also the similar calculations like LDA, but I didn't come to the end, but plus you.
I saw that item. I wish you could get to that, but we can.
But then they would also fail. Maybe it's like you and six, you don't get the correct spectral density that you would need at the band edge. So if they just shift the band, you would really need 88 plus 100 which gives you somehow also, that's my impression at least.
I think, you know, dynamical mean field is not maybe very important. I think you need to do something partly phenomenological, ultimately.
Put the spin in by hand.
There's lots of things to learn from these calculations, but to really get the magnetism right, you have to put in something phenomenologically, although you're going to reach a different conclusion, so go ahead.
In this calculation, I calculate the energy difference between ferromagnetic and the paramagnetic state and estimate Curie temperature by using mean field approximation and discuss the origin of the ferromagnetism. So this is explanation for coherent potential approximation, but I did it in the introduction, so I just skip it. And as you might know, for classical Heisenberg model, Curie temperature is calculated as shown here. So the Curie temperature is sum of the coupling constant. And by using the mean field approximation, you can calculate the energy difference between ferromagnetic state and the local moment disordered state. And this energy difference contains the sum of the exchange coupling constant. So you just put this equation here and you get final result for Curie temperature. Curie temperature is calculated from energy difference, as shown like here. And this is a calculation result by mean field approximation, and this is the Curie temperature as a function of manganese concentration. And this is gallium manganese nitride, phosphide, arsenide, and antimonide. And you find very different concentration dependence for gallium manganese nitride and gallium manganese antimonide. And from this different concentration dependence, you can discuss the origin of the ferromagnetism. In order to discuss this origin of the magnetism, I calculate the density of states for gallium manganese nitride, phosphide, and arsenide and antimonide. The red line shows the total density of states, and the blue line shows the partial density of manganese 3D state. And you have two typical cases. One is gallium manganese nitride and gallium manganese antimonide. And in this case, you have a very clear impurity band in the gap, and the Fermi level is located in this impurity band. And this is one typical case, and this is the other typical case. And in this case, the manganese D state is very deep in the valence band, and the whole state is mainly consists from the host valence band. So you have two typical cases, and for these cases, dominant ferromagnetic mechanism is different. And in this view graph shows the main mechanism for the ferromagnetism in DMS. This is a schematic density of states of gallium manganese nitride, and in this case you find the impurity band. And the Fermi level is located here, so due to the broadening of this impurity band, you can gain the band energy in ferromagnetic state. This is a so-called double exchange mechanism. And in this case, this band energy gain is proportional to the band width of this impurity band. And band theory says that this band width is proportional to the square root of impurity concentration. So in this case, the energy gain is proportional to the manganese concentration. So this explains the root C behavior in Curie temperature in gallium manganese nitride reasonably. The other extreme case is PD exchange mechanism. This is typically in gallium manganese antimonide. In this case, D state is below the host valence band. So due to the hybridization between these D states and the host valence band, this state is pushed up and this state is pushed down. So if you have some holes, this host valence band is polarized. And this polarization effective field at the manganese site mediates the ferromagnetism, ferromagnetic interaction between manganese. In this case, this effective field is proportional to the manganese concentration, so as a result, you find linear concentration dependence in Curie temperature. So this is the first example for using the DLM calculation for finite temperature magnetism in DMS systems. This is the first part of my talk, and next I'd like to give you the accurate calculation of Curie temperature by using the mapping method. So this method I already explained in the introduction. And in case of dilute magnetic semiconductor systems, first you have to calculate the effective medium by CPA. So random distribution is manganese random distribution is simulated by CPA medium. And then you put two manganese at site I and site J and calculate the energy change due to the rotation to magnetic moments. And you get the exchange coupling constant. By this way, I calculate the exchange interactions in dilute magnetic semiconductors and for gallium manganese nitride, phosphide, arsenide, and antimonide. Exchange interaction is calculated as a function of distance. And if you find that in gallium manganese nitride, so I call double exchange system, you find very large exchange interaction for nearest neighbors. But it decays very fast, and the interaction range is short-ranged. This is due to the exponential decay of the wave function of deep impurity states. On the other hand, in case of gallium manganese antimonide and gallium manganese arsenide, interaction strength is weaker than this one, but the interaction range is longer-ranged. because in these cases, the PD exchange mechanism dominates, so host polarization of host valence band mediates the ferromagnetic interaction. So in this case, interaction range could be longer range. So once you know in this case, magnetic interaction is very short ranged, you immediately realize that this kind of magnetic percolation problem should be very important in short-ranged case. This this effect is very easy to understand, and I will explain this effect by using two-dimensional square lattice example, and I consider only nearest neighbor interaction. And this is a two-dimensional square lattice, and magnetic ions are indicated by blue squares. So if you have 100% of manganese, you have perfect magnetic network, but due to the dilution, this magnetic network is weakened, and below percolation threshold, you have small clusters. They are not correlated each other. So under percolation threshold, you lose ferromagnetism. This is reality, but in our mean field approximation, dilution effect is included only in the concentration factor C. So at low concentration, you find ferromagnetic solution. So here, mean field approximation is unrealistic. And this is a table of the for the percolation threshold for various lattices, and in FCC case, you need 20% for percolation for this nearest neighbor model. So short-ranged case, you have to take this effect into account. And this is some example for the effect of percolation, effect of percolation. And I calculated the Curie temperature as a function of concentration for nearest neighbor Heisenberg model in FCC lattice. And this red line shows the mean field result, and this blue point crosses shows the Monte Carlo simulation value. So higher concentration, mean field approximation is okay, but for lower concentration, system is not ferromagnetic, but mean field approximation still predict ferromagnetic solution. So here, this calculation is not realistic. So in order to take this into account, I calculate the Curie temperature of DMS by using the Monte Carlo simulation. So as you might know, in Monte Carlo simulation, thermal average of physical observable, in this case, magnetization, is calculated by using the Metropolis algorithm. For DMS systems, first I prepare a very large supercell and distribute manganese randomly. And then I suppose magnetic coupling between site I and site J, and they are calculated by Lichtenstein's method. And then I do the Metropolis algorithm and calculate the expectation value of magnetization. And analyzing this temperature dependence of magnetization, you can estimate the Curie temperature. And this is the calculation result for these DM systems by using the mean field approximation, red line, and random phase approximation, and Monte Carlo simulations. And the experimental values are also indicated by this red squares. And for gallium manganese arsenide and gallium manganese antimonide case, their interaction range is long-range interaction. So in particular, for higher concentration, mean field approximation gives a good estimate for Curie temperature. And in case of gallium manganese arsenide, you find a very good agreement between between theory and experiment, as shown here. But here already mean field approximation overestimates Curie temperature very much. On the other hand, in gallium manganese nitride, where the interaction range is very short range, in particular for low concentration, mean field approximation prediction is qualitatively long. So here, for low concentration, the system is in principle paramagnetic, but mean field approximation gives very high Curie temperature. So in gallium manganese arsenide, we get very good agreement between theory and experiment. So maybe I can say that in gallium manganese nitride or some wide band gap semiconductors, it is very difficult to get high Curie temperature, as shown in this calculation. So this this is an example of the simulation by using the mapping method for this dilute magnetic system. And maybe I have some more time. So as shown here, theory doesn't predict high Curie temperature, but in experiment, sometimes very high Curie temperatures are reported. So next, I'd like to discuss what is the origin of this high Curie temperature phase. Recently, by experiment, it is shown that in dilute magnetic semiconductor systems, magnetic impurities are distributed very inhomogeneously. For example, this is a result of chromium-doped aluminum nitride, and this is chromium-doped gallium nitride. They are reported from Arizona group, and they used transmission electron microscope technique and electron energy loss spectroscopy, and they observe inhomogeneous distribution of chromium. And the white region shows a high concentration region of chromium. As shown here, they found a quasi one-dimensional structure, and at the same time, they observed very high Curie temperature, as shown here. But if they grow different substrate temperatures, then they get this kind of small spherical clusters, and they lose ferromagnetism. So this experiment says that this kind of inhomogeneous distribution should be very important to understand the ferromagnetism in wide band gap DMS systems. And I'd like to introduce this kind of inhomogeneous distribution into my simulation. In order to do so, first I calculate the chemical pair interaction between magnetic impurities in DMS. This is very similar method as Liechtenstein method, but this is called the generalized perturbation method. And in this method, you calculate the energy difference between gallium-gallium manganese-manganese pair and two gallium-manganese pairs. And this Vij means the effective coupling constant between manganese in DMS systems. And by definition, negative Vij means effective attractive interaction. And by using this method, I calculate the chemical pair interaction between manganese in gallium manganese nitride and gallium chromium nitride, in this case between chromium and gallium manganese arsenide. And as shown here, the pair interaction is always, most of the pair interactions are negative, and this means that there are very strong attractive interactions between between magnetic impurities, and these systems have has tendency toward phase separation. And if you simulate phase separation by using this chemical interaction, by using Monte Carlo method, you get this kind of inhomogeneous distribution impurities. This big figure shows gallium manganese nitride. Manganese concentration is 5% and 20%. And I start from, so it is difficult to see, but this red point shows a manganese position in gallium manganese nitride. And nearest neighbor manganese are connected by white bars. And I start from random distribution and proceed the Monte Carlo simulation to simulate the inhomogeneous distribution of manganese. And after some time, due to the effective interaction, you find this kind of clusters in gallium manganese nitride. And for higher concentration, this phase separation gives this kind of very strange structure, very connecting random pattern. And if you calculate the Curie temperature as a function of this Monte Carlo step, you find that because you have this kind of magnetic network connecting random pattern, so higher concentration, you have this increase enhancement of Curie temperature. On the other hand, for low concentration, you only find the small clusters. So there is no percolation path between these small clusters. So Curie temperature is but if you introduce some layer by layer growth condition into this simulation, you can find this kind of quasi one-dimensional structure, which is very similar to the structure observed in experiment. So in this case, this is zinc chromium tail and gallium manganese nitride case. And in this case, chromium and manganese concentration is only 5%, but using this layer by layer crystal growth condition, you find very large clusters. So considering this simulation result, I would like to propose that in order to understand the ferromagnetism, ferromagnetic behavior of this material, it's important to think about the super paramagnetic blocking phenomenon. And I come to the summary. And at the beginning of this talk, I explained ab initio simulation method for finite temperature magnetism, and I explained disordered local moment technique and mapping of the Heisenberg model plus statistical method. And I applied these two methods for the study of dilute magnetic semiconductors. And I discussed the mechanism of ferromagnetism in DMS, and I show the accurate Curie temperature calculation. And at the end of my talk, I discuss some effect of inhomogeneous distribution of impurities in dilute magnetic semiconductors. So thank you very much. Yes.
What people are interested in is not just the fact you have ITC, but also that the material is conducting at the same time.
Uh-huh.
So let's stage these simulations. Do you know whether you have metal or
okay.
Insulator?
So this is already phase separated. So this dark area is a pure zinc tail light. And this bright area, yes.
It will be insulated.
Yes, insulator. But this white region is chromium telluride, so could be metallic. So some mixture of two phases.
So you could have some anisotropic
conduction? Maybe. These lines and these lines should be anisotropic, if this is correct. Yes. Independent. This system, you mean?
Or it depends on the type of cluster. We need the surrounding materials to get something in the transport.
Yes.
Even at very high speed, it should not see the transport.
Yes, so for example, this white region could have high temperature and ferromagnetic.
And the other region that just not semiconductors.
So if you
introduce some carriers into this
region, then you could have a chance to have some spin dependent transport. Maybe it's done. Okay, thank you.